From KCRW, this is Greater LA. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we're at Echo Park Lake, where the fountain is bubbling, the birds are singing, and the swan boats are gliding all across the water.
We're here at the park today, just playing and having fun, enjoying the ducks and the day.
Kiki Spencer and the baby she nannies visit the park often, despite the fact that a fence around its borders has made getting inside a bit of a hassle. You have to use one of the several gates that are kept locked at night. The chain link barrier has been up now for exactly 2 years.
At a point in time before it was up, I could remember we had access, you know, to the park. And so it was a bit of an inconvenience, especially on summer days where it's just super hot and we're just trying to get in and cool down, you know, find a little shaded area.
The fence went up after the city cleared a large homeless encampment here. It was a flashpoint in LA's homelessness crisis. Well, now a new city council member says it's time for that big chain link fence to come down. A decision that's putting neighborhood residents on two sides of their own proverbial fence. Here's KCRW's Zoe Matthew.
2 years ago, Echo Park Lake looked very different than it does today. Hundreds of people pitched tents in the park during the pandemic shutdowns, and it was quite a scene. With DIY showers, a garden, and regular food distributions, the encampment on the lake served as a central hub for local organizing and mutual aid efforts. And while some local residents viewed it as a nuisance, others said it was a critical lifeline for those experiencing homelessness. That's why, when Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell announced his plans to clear out the camp, activists came out in droves. Here's a Fox 11 report from March 24th, 2021.
Chanting slogans and carrying signs, hundreds converged on Echo Park to support the rights of the homeless to stay here in the commune-like encampment they've built up in the past year.
The protests at the park resulted in a huge police crackdown and more than 180 arrests. But despite the pushback, on March 25th, 2021, down came the tents and up went the now infamous fence, which closes off access to the park between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. Since then, the fence has become a divisive symbol in the neighborhood. It's been knocked down twice by activists and was a talking point in the 2022 city council election. Progressive political newcomer Hugo Soto Martinez says that when he took office in December, he had two goals for the park: to bring down the fence his predecessor had built and to prevent a new encampment from cropping up.
What we want to tell folks is that, you know, we can have both, that we can alleviate people's suffering and, you know, folks that are living in the street, and you can have a park that's accessible.
To do this, Soto Martinez says the plan is to ramp up outreach so unhoused residents are connected quickly with shelter and don't have a reason to sleep outside anymore.
We're saying we are a council that is going to lead with housing, not criminalization. And I think people are excited about that because that's what their demands were. Nobody wants to live in the street. Nobody does that on choice. And so we're saying we're going to provide those services up front.
His office has hired a team of staffers to collaborate with local service providers, offering shelter to the unhoused community. They recently worked with Mayor Karen Bass's office, which takes a similar approach to clearing encampments, to offer motel rooms to unhoused people living near the lake. Soto Martinez's homelessness director, Patrick Mooney, says that most accepted.
I think the statistic here is 98%. We're now at 63 individuals adjacent to the park that have gone into Inside Safe nearby and in the community in a place that they feel welcome.
The office has also been meeting with people who used to live at the Echo Park encampment to help shape their outreach strategy, like Queen Mendez, who was one of the last people removed from the lake during the 2021 sweep. She says she still has a tough time trusting the city government, but she's hesitantly hopeful about Soto Martinez's efforts.
It's just, I'm not a fortune teller. You know, I can't see what's going to happen tomorrow. But I see that, you know, I see him in the streets. I see him with the people. And that's something completely different than what we had with our prior councilman.
Soto Martinez has also done a lot of outreach to housed residents. Sonia Verdugo, an organizer for the activist group Ground Game LA, helped lead an effort to knock on more than 1,500 doors to chat with people about plans for the park. Verdugo, who was previously homeless herself, says the conversations have been fruitful.
I've been on both sides of the fence, you know, both sides of what's going on. So I think it makes it easier for me to talk to people and kind of explain what's going on instead of them just jumping to the conclusion of, oh, no, everybody's going to, you know, move back into the park with tents.
Still, if you visit Echo Park Lake, sentiments about the fence coming down remain split. Some, like Eleanor Wells, can't wait.
Kind of felt like a little, like a pin of sorts, you know, and it's supposed to be something that everyone can enjoy and enter from any sort of street, and to deprive the neighborhood of that is really tragic.
Others, like Patricia Bauer, are less than thrilled by the prospect.
The park needs to be closed at 10. Without the fence, it's almost impossible to do that. People can't party here at like 3 a.m., loud music and things like that. It keeps the wildlife in, it preserves the beauty of the park. It was a bad thing with when we had so many homeless here. It was just filthy.
These tensions came to a head at a standing room only town hall last weekend, where Soto Martinez stood before a restless and divided crowd. Some asked for more details about how unhoused people from the park would be cared for or connected with housing. Others demanded more time to hash out the plan. And a vocal few, toting Save the Fence signs, pushed for the structure to stay up permanently.
We have had enough of this, and the park being fenced at least protected an area where we could go and walk, exercise, see our neighbors, visit one another, see nature, and enjoy it. And we want to keep that. And I'm sure everyone here who lives in the area wants to also maintain the beauty of the park and the safety of the park. Thank you.
Councilmember Soto Martinez responds.
Yes, and I agree. Those objectives, those goals that you want, are the same goals that I want. The idea is that the only way to do that is with a fence, and I'm saying that we don't need a fence to do that, right? So hold on.
So as locals look towards the future of Echo Park Lake, friction remains, but Soto Martinez says that's to be expected.
Some folks, you know, still have their opinion, but we just wanted to do things very differently. You know, not shy away from the tension, but rather embrace it. I mean, this is part of the democratic process, you know. So I've really enjoyed it.
As for Mendez, who once lived in the park and now has her own apartment, she hopes taking the fence down will be the first step towards healing a broken community.
You know, the safety of the community comes within the community members itself, comes in within the relationships that we have within one another. You know, a fence doesn't equal safety. We equal safety.
While there's still no word on exactly when the fence will come down, officials say they're pushing to make it happen by the end of the month. For KCRW, I'm Zoe Matthew.
As a contributing member to KCRW, it really is a home away from home. I'm a transplant to LA, and now I've been here for 5 years, and it's really an institution in this city, from the music, the culture, to the news. LA wouldn't be the same to me without KCRW, so I will continue to support so long as I live in the city or don't live in the city. Thank you guys so much. Everyone, please support.
Donate today. We need you this spring to keep KCRW going. Go to kcrw.com/give.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Drag has long been a form of expression and escape, complete with glitter, glitz, and glam. It's an art form famous for elaborate costumes, groovy music, and, of course, that energy, that celebratory energy. Well, now a new exhibit in Honor Fraser Gallery in Mid-City celebrates 70 years of drag history with an exhibit titled Make Me Feel Mighty Real, Drag, Tech, and the Queer Avatar. The exhibition features works by more than 40 artists and media ranging from photography and painting to film, performance, and even animation. Jameson Edgar is the director of Honor Fraser Gallery. He joins us now to talk about the exhibit and the history that it represents. Jameson, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for having me.
Make Me Feel Mighty Real, huh? Where does the name come from? I think I know.
Yeah, so the real disco fans out there will know and should hear the Easter egg that the exhibition's title comes from the spectacularly fabulous disco anthem Make Me Feel Mighty Real, which is a Sylvester song, so much about kind of finding yourself and feeling your most real, authentic self when you're in this like altered state on the dance floor with other queer people. And that's kind of how the title came to be.
Yeah. What about the rest of the title, Drag, Tech, and the Queer Avatar? What's the relationship between drag and technology?
Yeah, so that was a really exciting thing that we wanted to do with this show. So there's been a number of amazing exhibitions on the history of queer art and some on drag performance, but we wanted to really think of a different lens to bring to this curation. And one thing that we started to think about and we started to notice was the ways in which queer artists have always collaborated with technology. And I think in the kind of contemporary moment, you see that, you know, during the pandemic, so many drag artists were so quick and so kind of creative and spontaneous to move to Zoom, or they started to use these online platforms. But that same kind of impulse and tradition has existed for so long. So Andy Warhol, with his instant cameras and his stereoscopic film, the Cockettes in San Francisco in the 70s were responding to the first live broadcast televisions that were kind of celebrity hits. And that's moved through the 80s into the 90s. And it really has just, technology has always been this kind of unseen companion for queer people. And we wanted this show to really highlight that.
But also, you know, as I mentioned at the top, the history of drag, 70 years. 70 years is a long time, obviously, but drag goes way further than that, right?
Yeah, it definitely does. And I mean, you can go further back. I mean, there's one work in the exhibition that is featuring kind of one of the, it's a portrait of one of the first ballroom performers who, you know, has, who is kind of showing up and performing. And she was performing in the late 19th century. So it goes much further back. The reason we picked the 50s was as a kind of a starting point and moving on is because this is kind of the moment, you know, where this question of visibility and queer visibility and how we can be in space safe together and express queer desire and queer fabulousness and all of its glitter and gore happens. So it starts in the 50s with an amazing ephemera collection by my co-curator, Scott Ewald, who has been collecting publications and ephemera from the 50s and 60s that were oftentimes disseminated via mail and secretly via mail. So even then, this kind of idea that we can hack the mailing system to share our voices was a lot of the work that's happening in the 50s. And then, you know, all of a sudden Stonewall happens, which is this kind of marker, the Stonewall riots, there's this marker in a lot of people's kind of idea of queer history is this big expressive riot that really starts off queer liberation. But we wanted to show exactly by starting before that, that these fights and these dreamings and this way of being creative has existed long before that.
And yet, here we are in the year 2023, and we've got all these anti-LGBTQ+ legislation that's out there, anti-trans, This is really a time in this kind of movement, right?
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing about the exhibition is, you know, these attacks against queer communities have been happening long before, you know, these initial bans. But even within the length of curating this exhibition, the politics around it have gotten so much more in focus. You know, we really started the exhibition as a way to celebrate and champion these queer artists. And all of a sudden, the legislation and the, quite honestly, like uninspired attacks against queer and trans people have just put it into a different kind of lens and a feeling. And I would encourage people to come to the exhibition with that in mind and to see the ways in which many of the artists that are in the exhibition have been dealing with that same type of affront their whole lives and the ways in which they use their art form to get around it. But to the point of, you know, the bans that are happening now, I mean, I'm from the South. I grew up, you know, in a relatively conservative part of the country. And I that's where I found my own queerness. It's where I found my first queer community. And I hold the spectacular defiance that the queer community in these Southern and more conservative states have. And oftentimes it's not able to be as visible, and it's not able to be, you know, out in front of so many, you know, cameras or other spaces. But there is this undeniable fact that queer people love to make things for and with each other.
Jameson Edgar, the director of Honor Fraser Gallery, where the exhibit Make Me Feel Mighty Real, Drag, Tech, and the Queer Avatar runs through May 27th. Jameson, thanks for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. LA County has seen more than twice as much rain as it usually gets in the wet season, three times as much in some spots. So let's just say the water is flowing, which means it's time to rejoice in the splendor that are waterfalls. They are scattered everywhere around Greater LA, if you're willing to hike to them. Chris Hazard, a.k.a. The Hiking Guy, who has the website hikingguy.com, is here to tell us where to find some of the best waterfalls across the area. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right. Wet. It's been wet.
Yes.
All over this place. What is it about finding a waterfall on a hike? I mean, it can be, and I know I've done this before, although my friends will laugh saying that I go on hikes a lot. I go on hikes somewhat. And I'll see like a trickle here or there, and people are just overwhelmed by the little trickle. Now it's not so much a trickle, is it?
No, now actually we have the problem that some of the waterfalls you can't even get to because there's so much water flowing between the rain and the snow melt. We have some trails that, you know, normally you might have had a stream crossing that was a few inches. Now it's like waist deep and you can't even get to it.
And where are these places? I know there are some places to go along, well, near PCH, right, along the coast in Malibu, but also in the mountains when you're talking about Altadena, Pasadena, you know, the San Gabriel Valley and in the foothills around there. What are some of the best places to hike to see these waterfalls?
Yeah, well, the nice thing is we have a ton of choices here in the LA region. You mentioned the coast. I mean, the most popular one probably on the coast is Escondido Falls up in Malibu, which is not bad. It's less than 2 miles to get there, about 4 miles round trip. But the waterfall is really unique. It's about 150 feet, and it comes down this limestone mossy cliff. So It doesn't look like a waterfall. It almost looks like coming down like a green beard. It's pretty cool.
And Altadena, I'm sure, has some great views too of waterfalls.
Yeah, Altadena, you have a lot of big ones. You have Millard Canyon, which is a pretty easy one. I've seen little kids on that. That's less than a mile from the parking area to get to. Right now, it's probably flowing. It's a cool canyon because it stays shaded for most of the year, so it becomes one of the most biologically diverse areas. There's salamanders and all kinds of cool things there. You'll see artists doing oil paintings there. And that's a cool one. And then nearby in Altadena, you have Eaton Canyon, which is probably the most popular one, one of the most popular hikes here in Southern California. I always like that one because you start in an LA County park. There's like a nature center and it feels like a county park. But after walking a little bit, you actually enter Angeles National Forest and then you feel like you're in the foothills, like really steep hills, dramatic landscape. And then there's the Eaton Canyon Falls, which are beautiful as well. Another great one up there is Switzer Falls. That's probably like the granddaddy of all the waterfalls here in Southern California. Back in the, I believe the 1880s during the Great Hiking Era, when hiking was a big thing, there was actually a resort there. When I say resort, you're probably picturing like a big Hawaii resort. This was like a little cabin.
For 1880s, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there was a resort there. And if you drive up to the Angeles Crest Highway and you do this short hike about 2 miles each way, you can actually pass the remains of the old resort. And there's like foundation, but there's also the old stoves that are probably, I mean, maybe 100 years old, big old rusty stoves there that you continue on. And there's Switzer Falls, which is another, you know, dramatic, beautiful waterfall here.
Probably the same terrain that John Muir would hike, right, back in the day.
You want to know something? John Muir, the word is that he actually stayed at that Switzer.
Really?
Switzer camp base. It's called Switzerland, because that's cute, but but he was there at one point.
but wait a second, Chris, that's a different country.
Switzerland off the Angeles Crest Highway, yes.
You know, the mountains got so much snow. You mentioned Angeles Crest in the Angeles National Forest. Mountains got so much snow. When you have a lot of snow, especially in the springtime, late spring, it really starts to melt, right? Or even when it just rains, it starts to melt.
Yep.
Hence waterfalls happen, right?
Yeah.
So is that a danger? Does it mean we're going to see just a ton more waterfalls in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, I mean, the waterfalls will definitely last longer. Once you have that snowpack up in the mountains, that essentially fuels all of the waterfalls. So they might not be raging in a month, maybe if the rain stops, but you'll have a nice flow. So even if you don't want to go out now and, you know, right now when it's raining or if it's pouring out, it's usually not a good time, like I said, because it's just so, those streams can get so swollen. There's already been rescues this year from streams. But if you go up a little bit later in the year, maybe in May, the waterfalls should be flowing pretty nicely.
How would you assess the conditions of the trails right now if you were to give some advice?
Yeah, the trails are not great in condition, and you should definitely check with the park, go to the park website or the social media before you go out, because a lot of trails do close when the conditions are a little bit wet like this. Not a little bit wet, a lot wet. So,
why do you think LA is such a hike town? Is it a social thing? Is it a natural beauty? I mean, there's so much natural beauty around here, but a lot of people like to hike, especially on Tinder.
I'm not sure about Tinder, but I just know, as somebody who moved here later in life, this is like a playground for hiking in the outdoors. I mean, from LA, within an hour, you have world-class trails that you couldn't find, anywhere else.
Again, the website is hikingguy.com. Chris Hazard, named such, Hiking Guy. Thanks, Chris, for coming on. Happy trails to you.
I had a blast. Thanks so much, Steve.
That's all the time we have for now. Next week, meet the group that's trying to help people make new friends with some open-to-anyone mixers. You can consider it speed friending. How about that? Conservatives are making the classroom a political flashpoint. In the city of Orange, the newly lurched right school board fired the superintendent. What are they hoping for? How much of an effect will there be in the classroom? That's next week on Greater LA. Asking, of course, for your support. Stories like that take a lot of effort and, yes, money, too. Your support of KCRW powers the reporting that we do on Greater LA. It powers the handpicked music you hear by our DJs, the cultural programs, too, at kcrw.com/give during our spring pledge drive. And if you donate today, you automatically get entered into our Coachella Experience sweepstakes, a couple of VIP passes, can you believe it, to the Desert Festival next month, where you can see superstar acts including Rosalia, Wet Leg, Frank Ocean, Gorillaz, and more. kcrw.com/give is the way to do that through tomorrow night. And while you're there, drop us a line, share a story too, share your thoughts, and tell us what's on your mind. KCRW.com/GLA and grab the podcast there while you're at it. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, Phil Richards, John Meek, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time. And of course, that ear. Have a great night.